have no peace. That's because you're an actor, and you're famous. You can't do your job without an audience, and you have a big one, so people recognize you, Ian said. That's the price of success in your business. Or are you talking about the pressure of carrying a show, and knowing everybody else's job is to look at you all day for lighting, camera, wardrobe, makeup, or sound?
No. It's beyond that.
Ronnie lowered the footrest and leaned forward, confiding in Ian.
They're always watching, even when I'm alone and nobody is around. They're listening, too.
Who are they? Ronnie shook his head. Either it was too complicated or pointless to explain.
I feel like there's no escape.
Ian nodded as if he understood, which he didn't. Sure there is.
Where?
The same place I go to. The world of Charlie Vine. But you have it better than me. I can imagine it, and I can sit in it, but you can live it. You can do it right here, but especially out there, on the police station set, where the scene is waiting for you to bring it to life.
Where there are three cameras in my face, and a microphone right above my head?
Only before the director says, action, when you're still Ronnie Mancuso, Ian said. But in the next instant, you're Charlie Vine, and that all disappears. It's not a set anymore. There are no cameras or microphones. It's another place, a world of pure imagination.
Ian had to stop himself before he broke into song, though he heard Gene Wilder singing in his head. The sad thing was that even though none of it was on the page, this was the best writing he'd done all day.
Ronnie glanced toward the glow of lights that illuminated the police station set, then looked back at Ian, acknowledging what he said with a nod.
You're right. Here I'm fine. It's out there in the real world where I have to worry.
You have nothing to worry about out there either. You're an actor. They'll only see what you want them to see, and hear what you want them to hear, because you can be anybody you want to be. That's your superpower. The power of illusion.
Ronnie got to his feet and took a deep breath. He was ready to work again.
You're writing the script for next week's show.
Uh-huh.
How's it going?
I'm down here, sitting in the Vines' house, Ian said. That should tell you something.
Great, Ronnie said. So I'll be getting another shit script that'll have to save with my performance.
Ronnie winked and walked out. But he was right. That was exactly what would happen.
Chapter 29. Blackthorn Global Security Headquarters, Bethesda, Maryland, July 20th, 3:25 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Blackthorn's entire media wall was filled with a high-definition bird's-eye view of Klamath Falls, Oregon, from the combat drone's camera, creating the vivid illusion that Cross could walk out of the room and plunge thousands of feet to the ground below. It reminded him of his early days as an operative, leaping out of airplanes into war zones to covertly assist the rebels on the ground in overthrowing their governments. The CIA called it regime change. It rarely worked, but that didn't stop the agency from repeating the mistake. The police went to the house in Seattle, Victoria reported, breaking into his thoughts. They found a woman's body. She swiped an image on her screen, and it appeared on the media wall in a window within the drone's aerial view. Cross looked up at a crime scene photo of a woman in a black jogging suit, impaled with a fireplace poker on a bloody kitchen floor. It wasn't Margot French.
"Who is she?"
he asked. "It's our asset," Victoria said. It was unbelievable to him. An obscene, practical joke being played on Cross by a cruel god. A trained assassin goes up against a writer with a broken arm and a dog sitter. And loses? How the hell does that happen? The only explanation Cross could think of was that his people missed something in their background checks of Ludlow and French. One or both of the targets were trained in self-defense. His money was on Ludlow, based on what was in his Straker books
and the fact that he'd survived 3 attempts on his life. But he wouldn't assume that French didn't have hidden combat skills as well. When this was over, he'd find the morons who'd made that monumental research blunder, and make them pay dearly for it. From now on, though, he'd treat Ludlow and French as if they were professional spies, 2 Russian sleeper agents on the run. Hell, maybe they were. It made as much sense as anything else that had happened over the last few days.
Make sure that any fingerprints in the house that don't belong to the owners or the dog sitter come back as dead ends, Cross said. I don't want the police finding Ludlow before we do.
No problem, Seth said. But soon the authorities will discover that the dog sitter has disappeared, if they haven't already. They might even learn that French was escorting Ludlow around Seattle, and that he hasn't shown up at his Denver signing.
Hopefully they'll both be dead before the police get that far along, Cross said. Do what you can in the meantime to wipe French and Ludlow from the picture, and slow the investigation down. Create a fake, unexpected trip for French. Perhaps to deal with a death in her family, or something along those lines to explain her disappearance. Create the entire travel trail, the same as we would to build a cover for an agent. Do the same for Ludlow. Notify Ludlow's publisher and the bookstores on his tour that he's had to cancel his appearances.
Consider it done, Seth said.
Victoria read some details on her screen. According to the police reports, the house was ransacked, and a vintage 1968 Mustang 390 GT Fastback is missing from the garage. They've got an APB out on it. Cross doubted that would lead anywhere. Ludlow had probably swapped the license plates with another vehicle. That's what a pro would do, and from now on, that's what he was assuming Ludlow was. But why did he pick such a distinctive car? A pro wouldn't want to stand out.
What other vehicles were in the garage?
A 2015 Porsche Panamera, a 2016 Range Rover, and a 2017 Ferrari, Victoria said.
Now it made sense. They were all showy cars. But Ludlow chose the only car without electronics and wireless connectivity. Smart move. He wondered if Ludlow had already ditched the car in favor of another, less showy vehicle. Something common, like a Toyota Corolla or Ford Focus.
Get a list of any car thefts that occurred in Seattle last night, and any that occurred along the route to Klamath Falls, Cross said. They may have changed vehicles. In the meantime, add the Mustang to the drone's search parameters.
Yes, sir, Victoria said. But we need a way to narrow down the search area. They could have gone anywhere after leaving Klamath Falls.
No, not anywhere. Ludlow was definitely going somewhere specific. Cross was certain there was a strategy behind Ludlow's actions. Maybe there had been from the moment he left Los Angeles and they'd missed it. Cross wouldn't underestimate Ludlow again.
He knows exactly where he's going and what he's doing. There's nothing random about his actions.
Cross turned to Seth.
Go through Ludlow's history of credit card statements and phone bills for any charges or calls within a 300-mile radius west, east, and south of Klamath Falls. Go back a decade.
Seth typed a few keys and scanned the results.
5 years ago, he bought a tank of gas with his American Express card in Cedarville, California, and then did it again 3 days later. He hasn't been back since.
On the big screen, a satellite view of Cedarville appeared. It was barely more than a rest stop on the northeastern edge of California, right at the Nevada border.
What's in Cedarville? Cross asked.
The last chance for food and gas before going into the Long Valley region of northwestern Nevada, Seth said, calling up a satellite view of that region on the media wall. It appeared to be nothing but grasslands and dry lake beds.
And what's out there?
A forgotten ghost town and hundreds of miles of wilderness, Seth said. It's virtually uninhabited.
It was more good news. Cross was beginning to see Ludlow's strategy, and it was flawed. Ludlow thought he could disappear in a desolate wasteland, when all he'd really done was make himself even easier to find.
As an added bonus, Cross wouldn't have to be subtle in his eradication effort. There wouldn't be anyone there to see it.
"Deploy the combat drone over Long Valley," Cross said. "Make sure the missiles are live."
Chapter 30. Ronnie gave Ian and Margot the grand tour. He led them out of the kitchen and into a long storeroom filled with pallets and shelves of medical supplies, cleaning materials, and food. He pointed out some items as they passed through the room.
"Antibacterial soap, lime, liquid bleach, heavy-duty garbage bags, kitty litter, paper towels, Tyvek disposable coveralls, baby wipes, bottles of lye, toothpaste, respirator masks, potassium iodate tablets," Ronnie said. "The usual."
"Yeah," Margot said. "Everything you'd find in my pantry." Ronnie gestured to the food.
"Rice, beans, salt, corn, sugar, wheat, honey, chocolate, powdered milk, canned meats, canned fruits, canned vegetables, and plenty of military ready-to-eat meals. The army makes a killer beef stroganoff."
"I'm sure they do," Ian said. "The army is well known for its gourmet chefs."
"Don't be such a snob," Ronnie said.
Margot paused beside a pallet of boxes, one of which was open and full of movie DVDs. "What's this?"
"I bought the entire DVD inventory of a mom-and-pop video rental place that went out of business in Encino. I also bought the fiction stock of a used bookstore in Reseda," Ronnie said, gesturing to another pallet of boxes. "Entertainment is going to be important for maintaining sanity during the end of days."
"What about your air, power, and water?" Ian asked. "Where does that come from?"
"The air comes from outside and goes through a nuclear, biological, and chemical filtration system. The intake and ventilation pipes above are concealed within artificial rocks and fake brush. A little trick I learned from my days in Hollywood," Ronnie said. "The shelter is powered by batteries stored here and fed by a camouflaged solar array, hidden a quarter of a mile away. There's also a backup generator system that runs on biodiesel fuel. The water is drawn directly from a well beneath us and underground storage tanks."
"What's in here?" Margot pointed to a vault door with a combination lock.
"The essentials for survival once it's safe to go above again?"
Ronnie entered the combination, spun the wheel, and opened the vault. Inside was a cache of weapons and ammunition, including sniper rifles, AK-47s, handguns, an assortment of combat and hunting knives, hand grenades, rocket-propelled grenades, and two rocket launchers.
"Holy shit,"
Margot said, but she wasn't talking about the weapons. Her eyes were on something else.
"Is that pirate treasure?"
Ian followed her gaze to the floor, where a dozen bulging gym bags were lined up against the wall. Two of the bags were partially unzipped, one full of gold coins, the other filled with silver ones. All that was missing was a treasure chest to put them in.
"That's $250,000 in precious metals," Ronnie said. "I'll need money when the smoke clears, and it's not like I can run to the ATM.
"What's wrong with cash?" Ian asked.
"After Armageddon, cash is only going to be good for starting fires or wiping your ass," Ronnie said. "Gold and silver will endure."
Ronnie closed the vault and led them to the next room, which had two bunk beds, some dressers, and a bookcase.
"This is the bunk room, in case I have a family down the road or friends I want to spare from extermination or extinction."
The next room was a full bathroom with a standing shower, a double sink with a granite countertop, and a toilet. Ian wasn't interested in how the toilet and sewage system worked, though Ronnie proceeded to tell him in detail and with pride. As Ronnie was explaining how his sewage system ground waste and blew it into a septic tank, Margot drifted into the master bedroom and shrieked.
"What the fuck?" she said.
Ian joined Margot and was startled to see a woman, naked under a transparent negligee, lounging on a king-size bed. Her legs spread suggestively, drawing attention to her exposed crotch and abundant pubic hair. It took an instant for Ian to realize that she wasn't a woman at all. but an incredibly lifelike silicone sex doll. He walked over to get a better look. The tiny details were convincing. Her nipples were erect, the imperfectly round areolas ringed with raised goose flesh. Her skin was sparsely freckled, creased on her knuckles and lightly on her brow. Her teeth were slightly crooked and not overly whitened, perhaps even stained a bit by too much coffee. A tiny scar on her chin from a long-ago accident gave her a touch of character. The giveaway that she wasn't human, alive or dead, was her open eyes. They were blue and a touch bloodshot, but there was a flatness to them that was beyond death and utterly inanimate. Even the eyes of a corpse had something in their texture that inexplicably conveyed that they'd once revealed an inner life. He'd learned that the other night when he looked into the assassin's dead face. The other key missing element was moisture in the mouth and eyes. Even a dead body conveys some sense of liquidity. Ian had learned that unpleasant fact, too, from the assassin.
"That's Wanda," Ronnie said with a big smile. "Isn't she gorgeous?"
"I thought she was a corpse," Margo said.
"She's very much alive," Ronnie said. "Her body temperature is 98.6, and her cooch is motorized."
"You're disgusting," Margo said.
"I'm practical, honey. We all have undeniable urges. After a year or two down here, with pestilence and plague raging up there, you'll be glad to have her for comfort and release."
She gave him a hard look. "What do you mean I would?" Ian's gaze drifted to a set of bookshelves, bulging with paperbacks. He immediately spotted the spines of his 6 Clint Straker novels. Apparently Ronnie hadn't bought the 7th yet, or he was waiting until it came out in paperback. Ian pulled Death Has No Mercy off the shelf. On the cover, a resolute Clint Straker stood against the backdrop of an enormous fireball that contained the skyline of Dubai, a woman in a bikini holding an AK-47, and a speedboat. He held the book up to Ronnie. "You're waiting until the end of the world to read my books?"
"I've read them all more than once," Ronnie said. "I fucking love Clint Straker."
"If you've already read them," Margo said, "why are they down here?"
"Because I expect the end of days will bring hardship and times when I doubt myself. Those books are here to give me strength in moments of despair, to remind me what one man can achieve with just guts and determination."
It was the nicest, most meaningful thing anybody had ever said to Ian about his books. "Really?" Ian asked. "You mean that?"
"You're a badass," Ronnie said. "A man of action who doesn't give up."
"You mean Straker is," Margo said. She was right about that. Clint Straker was everything that Ian wasn't. Straker didn't run from danger, he ran toward it. Straker was a born warrior, a samurai in blue jeans. That was never clearer to Ian than right now, hiding in a hole from his enemies, holding that book. And as Ian accepted that, he felt a strong, familiar urge, as real and desperate a need as hunger, thirst, or lust, one that made no sense, not in this place, not at this time. He wanted to write another Straker novel. Right now. Chapter 31. Cross looked down on the Mustang from the drone flying overhead. The dusty green car was parked outside of a cinder block ranch house and a small corral. From what Cross could tell from structures and equipment on the ground, the ranch existed solely to sustain somebody who wanted to live off the grid. But whoever that was, he was fooling himself. There was nowhere a person could hide if the right people wanted him found.
"The Mustang matches the description of the stolen car," Seth said. "However, the plates are registered to a 1998 Ford F-150 pickup in Seattle. Ludlow must have swapped the plates before he left the city."
"He did," Victoria said, excitement in her voice. "We have a match on all of the RFIDs from the groceries purchased in Klamath Falls.
They're still in the trunk of the Mustang. We also have hits on Ludlow and French's credit cards, coming from inside the house, along with 3 active heat signatures. She hit some keys on her keyboard, and the heat signatures showed up as red pulses in the house on the screen. The people in the house were moving around.
"That must be Ludlow, French, and whoever lives there," Cross said. "Do we have any idea who the owner is?"
"The property is owned through various shell corporations," Seth said. "It'll take some time to find the real person."
It would be nice to know who he was killing, but it wasn't a priority. Removing Ludlow and French from the playing field was all that mattered to Cross right now.
"It can wait," Cross said. "Rain hell upon them."
Victoria tapped a key. A hellfire missile shot out from the drone and hit the house dead center.
The house exploded, spitting flaming debris in all directions and igniting the nearby propane tank, which erupted in an enormous fireball. The explosions were deafening and rocked the underground shelter hard, nearly knocking Ian, Margot, and Ronnie off their feet. It was like they were on rough water. Actually, more like underwater. The sense of being in a submarine was so strong that Ian's first irrational thought was that torpedoes had just missed them and hit the ocean floor. He suspected that he wasn't far from the truth.
"Holy shit," Margot said, her eyes wide with fear.
But Ronnie whooped with delight, a big grin on his face.
"That's the New World Order knocking on my door. It's about fucking time."
He ran back to the main room, Ian and Margot right behind him. They all stopped in front of the big screen TV and stared at the multiple camera feeds.
Ronnie's house was obliterated. All that was left of it was a smoking crater and bits of flaming debris scattered all over the compound. One of the cows was on fire, running around the corral, sending up smoke signals.
For Ian, seeing the destruction on TV made it seem unreal, as if they were watching something he'd written instead of something that was actually happening. But if he'd written it, who was the hero? Ian glanced at the paperback of Death Has No Mercy in his hand. The tagline read, "Nothing stands in his way. The only fear Straker knows is what he sees in the eyes of his enemies." He looked up again and saw Ronnie grinning. Ronnie wasn't angry that his home was destroyed. He was thrilled. Everything he believed was finally coming true. Ian had always suspected that the happiest day of a survivalist's life would be the one when the world ended. Now he knew it was true. It was validation for all of Ronnie's psychological suffering and proof that he wasn't crazy.
"Is that the best you've got, you pussies?"
Ronnie yelled gleefully at the ceiling.
"Bring it on!"
Cross looked down on the destruction like a malevolent god hurling lightning bolts from the heavens at the mortals who displeased him. "This is what happens when you incur my wrath," he thought. The destruction gave Cross a hard-on, which fortunately nobody noticed because everyone's attention was on screen. Even so, he put his hands in his pockets to puff out his pants. He glanced at Victoria and wondered if she got off on it, too. She'd probably go home tonight and whip the skin off the back of some lucky bastard. The smoke cleared on the screen. He saw the crater where the house had once stood. Ludlow, French, and whomever they'd come to visit were now bone fragments and clumps of charred flesh. The backstory on this operation was finally erased. Now all that was left to deal with were the politics, though in some ways he favored this kind of action. It was clear and decisive. He saw the Mustang, covered in dust and ash, its windows shattered, but otherwise intact. Not good.
"Take out the Mustang," Cross told Victoria. "I don't want to leave any tracks that lead back to Ludlow or Seattle."
Victoria tapped a key. Another Hellfire missile flew from the drone. The explosion wiped out the car and left another crater. It was like using a tank to kill a fly, but at least now the car and its contents were dust.
Bring the drone home and send a team to collect whatever's left of the bodies for fingerprint, dental, and DNA analysis, Cross said. I want irrefutable confirmation of the kills.
Long Valley, Nevada, July 20th, 4:15 p.m., Pacific Standard Time. They waited 30 minutes after the drone flew away before they decided it was safe to leave the bunker and go above. Even so, Ronnie insisted on being armed. He took one of the rocket-propelled grenade launchers with him from the vault. Ian brought his Straker paperback. They emerged to scorched earth, two craters, and smoking rubble. The pickup truck was engulfed in flames, but the bulldozer and tractor remained, seemingly undamaged. The air reeked of burning rubber, wood, gasoline, and cow flesh. Margot squatted and picked up a few coins from the blackened earth.
I'm sorry, Ronnie, Ian said. I shouldn't have come here. I brought this on you.
It's not your fault, Ronnie said. This day was coming sooner or later, and I was getting tired of waiting for it. But it's not over. They'll be back.
Ian knew he was right. They would come for their remains and to clean up the crime scene. He wondered how long they had before the cleaners arrived. A couple of hours? A day? The thought made him look at the book in his hand. Clint Straker would relish the fight. Ian would, too, if he were writing it instead of living it. The fights were the scenes that every reader waited for, and they almost wrote themselves. That's because Straker was totally in his element, one man up against impossible odds, armed only with his determination and cunning. God, how Ian wished he were writing that scene now instead of standing there.
We have to get out of here.
Margot nodded at the bulldozer and tractor.
Those aren't going to get us very far, and the bad guys will notice right away if they're missing. We'll have to go on foot and try to cover our tracks behind us.
I've got a big woody, Ronnie said.
Good for you, Margot said, annoyed. Is it that time of day for you, or are you aroused by the idea of us running into the mountains and dying of exposure? Clint Straker doesn't run from anything. That thought made Ian understand why he had such a strong urge to write. He didn't want to escape the situation he was in. He wanted to beat it, the way Straker would. He looked down at the book in his hand, the one he wrote about the character he created. And in that moment, a chill passed over him, taking with it all of his anxieties. He knew what he had to do.
I'm talking about the 1974 Ford Country Squire station wagon that I've got hidden in a cave, Ronnie said. Cars manufactured after 1975 all have electronic ignitions that'll be fried by an EMP blast. This one is blast safe, and it has wood veneer paneling on the body.
Oh, Margot said. That kind of woody. Let's find the car, fill it with your weapons and treasure, and get the hell out of here.
No, Ian said. We're done running.
What's the alternative? Margot said. Hide in Ronnie's shelter for a year or two until they forget about us? Ian held up his paperback.
Clint Straker wouldn't run, and he wouldn't hide.
You aren't Clint Straker, she said.
Everybody keeps telling me that, but you're wrong, he said.
I am Clint Straker. I created him. Everything he is, everything he's ever done, came from within me. He's imaginary.
She grabbed the book out of his hand and flung it like a frisbee into the burning wreckage of a pickup truck.
You made up his past and everything that he does. You don't actually have his training or combat experience.
I have something more important. I know how he thinks and how he reacts. He doesn't wait for things to happen. He makes them happen, Ian said. It's time I stopped thinking like me and started thinking like him.
That's it, man. Get into character.
Ronnie clapped Ian on the back.
I got so into the vine that by episode 13, I was capable of photosynthesis.
Margot gave Ronnie a cold, hard look.
You can convert sunlight into energy.
Ronnie held out his arms and tipped his face up to the sky.
The sun is my Big Mac.
Oh, for God's sake, Margo said. Get real. We're talking about our lives here.
That's why it's time to embrace our true selves and harness our potential, Ronnie said.
He turned to Ian.
So, buddy, there's one question you've got to ask yourself. What would Clint Straker do right now?
He'd take the fight to them, Ian said.
Damn right he would, Ronnie said. It's going to be the three of us against the CI, fucking A.
That's suicide, Marco said.
Actually, it sounds just like a Clint Straker book to me, Ian said. All I need to do is plot it.
Margo took a deep breath, and when she spoke, it was in a calm, patronizing tone, like she was talking to a child.
When you're writing a book, you're in complete control of the universe. It doesn't work like that in the real world.
Is that so? Tell that to the CIA. If they could use my story idea to kill people in the real world, why can't I do the same thing to bring the CIA down? Someone has to make them pay.
Ian tore the duct tape off his cast, pulling chunks of plaster away and throwing them on the ground, until his pale, bone-thin right arm was revealed. He stretched his arm out and made a fist.
It's going to be me.
Ian sounded just like Straker, and he knew why. Because he was, and always had been, Straker inside. For the first time since this nightmare began, he felt strong and unafraid. Ronnie and Margo could see it too. Ronnie raised his RPG launcher.
I'm right there with you, man.
Margo looked at Ian for a long moment as she thought it over, and then sighed with resignation as she came to a decision that she appeared to already regret.
If we're dead anyway, we might as well go down fighting.
We're going to have to work on your winning attitude, Ian said.
Chapter 32. The enemy came in an unmarked black helicopter a couple of hours later. They flew in from the south and circled twice over the charred ruins and smoking craters, before landing about 50 yards from the compound. Two men emerged from the helicopter wearing dark sunglasses and white jumpsuits, white gloves and white rubber boots. They both carried toolboxes that Ian presumed, based on his extensive experience watching police procedurals on television, were evidence collection kits. Ian and Margo crouched side by side and watched the men from under a camouflaged tarp that was spread over several artificial boulders atop one of the rocky hillsides that bordered the compound. It was where Ronnie had been hiding when Ian and Margo drove in that morning. Margo used binoculars to track the men, while Ian watched them through the scope on the rocket-propelled grenade launcher that rested on his shoulder. The RPG launcher was essentially a tube with a rocket stuck in the front and a trigger on the bottom. Ronnie had given Ian and Margo a quick lesson in how to use it. It wasn't a complex device. Ian shifted his aim to the helicopter, putting the craft in the center of his sights. It would be a hard target to miss. The weapon was too heavy for Ian's weak right arm, so he propped the end of it on a rock in front of him, took a deep breath, and squeezed the trigger. The rocket shot out, the blazing backfire scorching the rocks behind Ian. An instant later, the rocket slammed into the helicopter and blew it apart. The concussive force of the explosion knocked the two men off their feet, which was fortunate, because a split second later a severed rotor blade sliced through the air where they'd stood. The two men landed face down on the ground. They lifted their heads and saw Ronnie under the tractor, smiling and pointing an AK-47 at their heads.
"Keep kissing the dirt, assholes," he said. "Hands behind your backs."
Up in their hideout on the hill, Margo grinned at Ian.
"That was great."
He grinned back at her.
"Now you know why my books are bestsellers. I can plot."
But writing it didn't compare to the exhilaration of actually doing it. The gleeful expression on Margot's face told him that she enjoyed the visceral experience as much as he did, even though she hadn't pulled the trigger. It just proved what everybody in Hollywood already knew. Everybody loves an explosion. Ian and Margot rose from their hiding place and made their way carefully down through the rocks to the ground, where Ronnie stood over the two men with his AK-47 aimed at their backs.
"Be still, boys," Ronnie said. "One twitch of my finger and you're both vulture chow."
Ian and Margot removed zip ties from their pockets, and they each took a man, first binding their wrists, then rolling them over onto their backs. The two men, dirt sticking to their sweaty faces, scowled furiously at their captors.
"It could be worse," Margot told the two men. "We could have shot you out of the sky."
Ian got the feeling that she would have been okay with that, too. He and Margot opened the men's jumpsuits and searched their pockets, retrieving wallets, key fobs, and photo IDs. Margot stood up and flipped through the wallet that she'd found.
"This one is Edwin Pessel."
Margot nodded at the man at her feet.
"He's a security specialist for Blackthorn Global Security in Las Vegas."
That didn't make sense to Ian. What did Blackthorn have to do with the CIA? Ian opened the other man's wallet and found another Blackthorn ID.
"This one is Stuart Bowers. He also works at Blackthorn." "Of course they do," Ronnie said.
Ian put his foot on Bowers' chest to keep him down and looked at Ronnie.
"Why, of course?" "Because Blackthorn is the SS of the New World Order. It's full of ex-spies, ex-politicians, war criminals, disgraced scientists, and professional psychopaths. Their job is to terrorize the populace so that they are so scared that they will gladly give up their freedoms in exchange for the false promise of safety."
"And you think these guys do that by flying jets into buildings?" Margot said.
"That's one way," Ronnie said. "The Kennedy, King, and Elvis assassinations, Watergate, AIDS, Botox, crop circles, the Ebola epidemic, opioid addiction, and genetically engineered fruit are just some of their greatest hits."
"You left out artificial sweeteners," Margot said.
"Because that goes without saying," Ronnie said.
Blackthorn was a plot twist that Ian didn't see coming. It changed his perspective about everything that had happened since Bob first knocked on his door. It also gave him hope.
"What if it's Blackthorn, not the CIA, that crashed the plane and is trying to kill us?"
"So what?" Ronnie said. "They're both puppets of the New World Order."
"I don't see how that makes things any better for us either," Margot said. "It's a game changer. I've met the man in charge of this conspiracy, but I don't know his name or anything about him."
Ian looked at Bowers, who glowered at him from under his foot.
"Now we have a way to find out."
Ronnie and Margot worked fast. She helped him bring up all the weapons, ammo, and other supplies that they needed from the bunker, while Ian stood guard with the AK-47 over Pessel and Bowers, who remained bound and on their backs in the dirt. Ronnie dismantled the bunker's surveillance system with a sledgehammer. Then he and Margot gathered up anything inside that could be used as a weapon or a tool, piled it all into the vault, and locked it up. When Ronnie and Margot came back to the surface, Ian told Pessel and Bowers to get to their feet and ordered them down the stairs. Ian, Margot, and Ronnie gathered around the hatch and looked down at the two Blackthorn operatives, who now appeared more fearful than angry.
"Here's what's going to happen," Ian said. "We're going to park the tractor on the hatch and leave, trapping you in that bunker. The good news is, after you break those zip ties, you can survive down there for years."
"Assuming you like freeze-dried beef stroganoff," Margot said. "And don't kill each other fighting over the sex doll."
"But first," Ian said, "you're going to tell us how to get into Blackthorn's building in Las Vegas, access their computers, and find photos of their senior employees without getting caught."
"Why the fuck would we do that?"
Pessel asked, practically spitting out the words.
"Because if we get captured or killed, nobody will ever know you're down there," Ian said. "You'll be buried alive for years."
"When the food runs out, one of you will murder the other for the meat," Ronnie said. "But that'll only buy you a few more weeks of solitary confinement, thinking about the savage thing you've done and knowing you're going to starve anyway, dying in wretched agony while you desperately suck the last speck of marrow from another man's bones."
"What a horrible way to die," Margot said. I can't imagine what it would be like. But Pessel and Bowers could. They told Ian everything he wanted to know.
Chapter 33. Ronnie and Margot took turns driving the 1974 Ford Country Squire on a 10.5-hour journey to Las Vegas. He drove the first 4-hour stretch, southwest into California so they could travel on paved roads, then due south for 200 miles on US 395, before they veered east again, crossing back into Nevada. They rolled into Reno at about 8 p.m. and stopped at a Goodwill store. Ronnie reluctantly ditched his aluminum foil helmet before he and Ian went inside. The men bought used business suits, ties, and dress shoes, while Margot went to a gas station and got them some food at Carl's Jr. Margot picked them up and stayed behind the wheel as they headed southeast, stopping 4 hours later at a Shell station in Tonopah, Nevada, which was on the northwestern edge of the 4,530-square-mile U.S. military range for aircraft gunnery training, aerial bombardment, nuclear weapons testing, and Army combat exercises. Their proximity to all of that secret military hardware and testing made Ronnie very nervous. He desperately wanted to put his aluminum foil helmet back on, but Ian convinced him it would draw too much attention to him. While Margot refilled the gas tank, Ian and Ronnie went to the restroom, where Ronnie shaved off his beard and they both changed into their Goodwill suits. Ronnie took over the driving and put his helmet back on. Nobody argued with him about the helmet. It was fine for him to wear it in a car. Ian figured the helmet was like a security blanket for him, and he couldn't blame Ronnie for feeling anxious. Ian wished he had a security blanket of his own, and thought about sucking his thumb instead, but it wasn't something Clint Straker would ever do. Margot hummed to herself for relaxation. It wasn't a song Ian recognized, so he assumed it was one of her own compositions. They reached Las Vegas at 3 a.m., cutting across the city to Henderson Executive Airport, a popular hub for corporate and private aircraft. This was where the helicopter and corporate jet used by Blackthorne's Las Vegas office were used. Ronnie parked the station wagon beside the black Suburban that Pessel had driven to the airport. It was Bowers who'd flown the helicopter. Ronnie took off his helmet, and the three of them got out of the station wagon. Ian pointed Pessel's key fob at the Suburban and unlocked it. He took a deep breath and tossed the key fob to Ronnie so he could drive. "Now comes the fun part," Ian said. "Good luck," Margot said. "They're the ones who are going to need it," Ian said. It was a Straker line, and it made Margot roll her eyes, but Ian liked how it sounded coming from his mouth. He and Ronnie walked toward the Suburban. It was a hero moment. Ronnie, being an actor, instinctively knew it, too, and it showed in his confident stride. "Wait," Margot said, and both men stopped. She went up to them and yanked the tags that dangled from their right sleeves. "You forgot to take off the price tags." That completely deflated the hero moment, but it didn't shake their confidence. Ian and Ronnie got into the Suburban, and they drove toward the glittering Las Vegas skyline. Las Vegas, Nevada, July 21st, 3:35 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Blackthorne provided enhanced security services for several casinos and operated out of a new 6-story building in downtown Las Vegas, a block west of the Plaza Hotel. It was one of the first buildings in an envisioned world-class office park, the latest attempt by the city to rejuvenate the heart of Old Town after a $70 million light show canopy over Fremont Street didn't generate much of a pulse. Ronnie stepped in front of the garage gate and next to a camera mounted beside the driveway. He rolled down his window and held up Pessel's ID to the camera so that it blocked most of his face from being seen by the lone, bored security guard on duty. The guard was stationed at a desk in the lobby and noted the name on the ID that filled the screen. He glanced at his computer. A scanner at the gate identified the Suburban as a Blackthorne vehicle that had been checked out by Pessel earlier that day. The ID and vehicle matched. Everything checked out. The guard hit the button to raise the gate and went back to watching Game of Thrones on his laptop. Ronnie drove into the garage. The first floor was filled with a fleet of identical black Suburbans and a few black Audi sedans.
He parked in an empty space by the elevator, and the two men got out, angling their bodies and faces away from the security cameras. Pessel and Bowers had told them where every camera was positioned. The operatives also assured them that there was little chance of anybody being in the building at that hour, besides the guard in the lobby. The elevator opened, and the two men stepped inside. Ian held Bowers' ID up to the scanner and hit the button for the fifth floor. The doors slid closed, indicating that the ID checked out and they had clearance to enter the building. The elevator went up, fast and smooth, into the belly of the beast. Margot pulled into the parking lot of the Main Street Station Casino and drove to one of the empty spaces along the far end, facing the office park. She positioned the station wagon at an angle so that the security camera mounted on the nearest light post wouldn't be able to get a clear look at her face. She got out, opened the door to the back seat, and slid out the rocket-propelled grenade launcher that was under a blanket on the floor. She crouched on the ground beside the station wagon, which hid her from the camera, balanced the rocket launcher on her shoulder, and aimed at the Blackthorn building. She didn't have any experience shooting rocket launchers, but she wasn't worried. Ronnie had taught her the basics of using the weapon, and she had a very big target. If she didn't get a signal from Ronnie in 5 minutes, she'd blow a hole in the sixth floor to draw the authorities and flush out everybody who was inside. The elevator opened on a wide, long floor filled with dozens of empty cubicles and lined with floor-to-ceiling windows. Ian and Ronnie had an unobstructed view from Glitter Gulch to the end of the strip, where the Luxor Pyramid shot a spotlight into outer space, beckoning any extraterrestrials who enjoyed blackjack, strippers, and all-you-can-eat buffets. The lights were on, and both men were keenly aware of the surveillance cameras mounted on the pillars around the room. The men had to assume that the guard in the lobby was watching them, out of boredom, if nothing else, so they had to be careful not to do anything suspicious. Ian went to Pessel's cubicle, sat down in front of the computer, and entered the operative's user ID and password. He was just a weary agent filing a late report. While he did that, Ronnie went to a window facing Glitter Gulch, positioning his body so the nearest camera wouldn't catch what he was about to do. He took a maglite out of his pocket and flashed it twice at the Main Street Casino. Margot flashed back twice in return from the parking lot. Now she knew they'd safely entered the building, and they knew that she had their backs. Ian followed the instructions that Pessel had given him and called up the employee list. The names were linked to individual pages with the employee's photo, short biography, and contact information. He started with the senior executives, calling up each entry until he saw Bob's face. It didn't take long. Ian was on his fourth name when Bob's picture came up. He felt an immediate jolt of recognition. Bob's real name was Wilton Cross, and based on his brief biography, Ian knew they wouldn't have found out his identity if they hadn't come here. Cross was a man who lived in the shadows, who stayed out of the public eye, and didn't exist in Google search results. He was also a man who crashed planes into cities and sent out assassins to kill novelists. "I've got him," Ian said. "His name, his phone numbers, everything we need." Ronnie came up behind him and looked over his shoulder. "Let's see the bastard." "Meet Wilton Cross. He works in Blackthorn's Bethesda, Maryland headquarters as their global chief of covert operations. He spent 2 decades doing the same dirty job for the CIA.
"I told you the CIA and Blackthorn were the same thing."
Ian wanted a picture of Cross. He tried to print out the webpage, but his access to do so was denied. "There's a crucial difference. Blackthorn is a business. They didn't crash that plane into Waikiki for ideology or patriotism. They did it for their bottom line.
World domination.
The almighty dollar." Ian tried to do a screen grab, but that was also denied. He didn't have a phone to take a photo of Cross's picture on the screen, so he settled for writing his phone numbers and address on a piece of paper, and then logged out of the computer. "There's a money-making angle to this somewhere. I don't know what it is, but it may be the key to taking this bastard down. Or there might be another way."
"I have the other way."
Ronnie opened his jacket to show Ian the gun holstered on his belt.
We drive to Bethesda, walk up behind him, and shoot him in the back of the head.
That would be murder.
He deserves it. The guy is responsible for killing hundreds of people.
But if we execute Cross, we won't be able to prove that and we'll go to prison.
You're a writer, Ronnie said. You'll come up with something.
Ian hoped so, because at the moment he had no plan and nothing to go on except a name and a face. Let's get out of here. Ian got up from his seat and the two men went to the elevator. It opened immediately. They took the elevator down to the parking garage and got back into the Suburban, and Ronnie drove them out, flashing his headlights twice as they emerged as a signal to Margot. As they headed away, Ian lowered his window and adjusted the side-view mirror so he could see the building receding behind them. They were a block away when the rocket-propelled grenade streaked from the Main Street Station Casino parking lot and slammed into the fifth floor of the Blackthorn building, the explosion blowing out the windows in a belch of fire and raining glass onto the empty street below. Ian and Ronnie shared a smile.
That'll get their attention, Ian said.
I'm so glad you came to visit, Ronnie said.
Chapter 34 Ronnie drove 2 miles north to a strip club that was famous for having totally nude dancers of both sexes. Ian heard that it was run by a criminal defense attorney who'd taken the club as payment for defending the owner, who was serving a life sentence for murdering the previous owner, who, in turn, was rumored to have killed the owner who'd preceded him. That was Las Vegas. The club was located between a motel and a pawn shop, both also owned by the attorney, both also taken in lieu of fees from clients in cases he ultimately lost. That was Las Vegas, too. In a decade, the attorney might own the entire city. Ronnie pulled into the strip club parking lot and found a spot in the back, near the motel. Ian and Ronnie got out. A moment later, Margot arrived in the station wagon and nearly jumped out of the car with excitement.
"What else can we blow up?" she asked.
"That's the problem with using explosives," Ronnie said. "It's like jerking off, eating potato chips, or watching Match Game. Once you start, you can't stop."
"It feels great to strike back instead of running," Ian said. "Now they can start being afraid."
"Do we know who we're scaring?" Marco said.
"Wilton Cross. He's the man who recruited me and the 3 other writers, Ian said. "He's the one we have to take down."
"How are we going to do that?" Ronnie asked.
"With a rocket, I hope," Marco said. "We can't beat them with our weapons," Ian said. "Our only option is to turn their strength into their weakness and..."
Margot interrupted him.
"Use their own force against them. Yeah, yeah, I know all that shit. It's straight out of your Straker books."
"It's also the ancient philosophy behind judo and other martial arts," Ian said.
"I know that too."
She put her hands on her hips and faced Ian.
"But what does that blah, blah, blah actually mean for us? How are we going to take down Blackthorn?"
"You mean the jackbooted army of the New World Order," Ronnie said.
"I mean the professional assassins who want to kill us and will find us anywhere we try to hide."
"I'll let you know as soon as I've worked out the fine points," Ian said. "But the first step is to get out of Las Vegas."
Bethesda, Maryland, July 21st, 7:49 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Wilton Cross's kitchen smelled like a bakery. Just breathing the air was fattening. The grandchildren were coming over that afternoon, so his wife, Sarah, was baking a cake for him. She'd started on it immediately after preparing fried eggs, crispy bacon, buttermilk biscuits, a bowl of strawberries, and fresh ground coffee for her husband, Wilton, who was eating his breakfast at the kitchen table, while reading the Washington Post and watching Fox News. He wore a red cardigan, one of the dozens in various colors and patterns that Sarah had bought for him. It was the kind of sweater that Hugh Beaumont, Fred McMurray, and Robert Young used to wear while playing sitcom dads. Nobody wore them anymore, not even on TV. But his wife insisted that he change into one as soon as he walked through the front door when he got home from the office. It fit with her manufactured and comforting image of him as an average family man,
An insurance salesman, perhaps, coming home from work? She didn't want to think about what he actually did. All she knew was that he worked for the government and that he couldn't talk about his job. But she wasn't stupid. He wouldn't have married her if she were. They'd met when they were both students in their 20s at Yale, where she majored in classical civilization, concentrating on Greek literature, and he studied political science with an emphasis on international relations. His studies had served him well in his current profession, but her literary interests these days were limited to the prodigious output of Nora Roberts and Janet Ivanovich. Sarah was gray-haired now, and her skin was lined, but she'd managed to keep her slim figure as she'd aged. If Cross squinted and imagined away the apron that she always wore, he could see the same woman he'd married decades ago. He did a lot of imagining when they were in bed, and he was sure that she did too. He'd aged and fattened over time, and knew that he'd grown more emotionally distant. That's because now there was far more of his life that he couldn't share with her than there was that he could. There was nothing about her that he didn't know. What she didn't tell him, he knew from the surveillance devices that watched her in the house and car, and recorded her conversations on the phone. Wilton had spent the night at home, and was planning to spend the day there as well, because he was no longer in crisis mode at the office. Ludlow was dead, and the operation was moving into the political phase, which was scripted and would unfold without him having to do anything. The bodies of Ayub Darwish and Habib Ibrahimi, the men framed for downing the Trans-American flight, had already arrived at Andrews Air Force Base. Their computers and cell phones were being analyzed by Blackthorn, which was redundant, since they were the ones who'd loaded them with the fraudulent emails, files, and photos that would prove that the terrorist group Harakat Harar al-Sham Islamiya was behind the crash and was planning more attacks. The CIA's ineptitude and grave operational shortcomings, and the threat they presented to the nation's security, would soon be abundantly clear to the Senate Intelligence Committee and to the President, if they weren't already. Although the cause of the plane crash and the key persons responsible for it had been identified, none of that information had been released publicly yet. It was still top secret until all of the facts were known by investigators, and it was decided how the credit for the discoveries would be divvied up among the players for maximum political gain. So far, only the information about the hacking device implanted in the Gordon Ganza 877 aircraft had gone public. That was the news that dominated the front page of the Washington Post this morning. On TV, Cross watched as Fox's Shepard Smith reported the details while showing video of grounded jets sitting on the tarmac at major airports. Smith: all Gordon Ganza 877s worldwide have been grounded, effective immediately, until each plane can be searched for a device that allows terrorists to remotely access the autopilot system. Any 877s still flying in U.S. airspace are being escorted to the nearest landing strips by fighter jets. Airports around the world are packed with stranded travelers. A travel nightmare like this has not been seen since 9/11. "Do we have to listen to this?" Sarah said, stirring something in a mixing bowl. "I want to see upbeat, happy things before the grandchildren visit. We don't want that negativity in our minds or in the house." "You're right. I'm sorry, dear." Cross picked up the remote and switched to HGTV. Property Brothers was on. It was a show about twin brothers who renovated houses. Sarah brightened immediately. She loved those renovation shows. Since she started watching HGTV, she'd remodeled their kitchen 4 times. He suspected she did it just so she could feel like she was participating in the action. She'd be able to do it a 5th time, and hire those freakish twins to do the work, with the money he'd be getting soon. His cell phone rang. He got up and stepped into the backyard before answering it. Sarah didn't like it when he talked business in the house. "Yes?" he said. "There was an explosion this morning at our Las Vegas office," Seth said. "No one was hurt, but the damage is extensive." He didn't believe in coincidences. Yesterday they'd killed Ludlow, French, and whomever they went to see in Nevada. Today there was an explosion in their Las Vegas office. Cross knew the blast had to be related in some way to that incident. But how? Had Ludlow somehow figured out that it was Blackthorne that was pursuing him? Was there something on the assassin in Seattle that tipped him off? Did Ludlow get